Greetings, this is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. This is another in this occasional series of readings from and brief notes and commentary upon Eusebius of Caesarea's The Ecclesiastical History. Here is Book 7 and Chapter 32. At that time, Felix, who had presided over the Church of the Romans for 5 years, was succeeded by Eutychianus. This person did not survive for even 10 entire months. He left the office to Gaius, our contemporary. And when he had presided for about 15 years, Marcellinus was appointed his successor, the same whom the persecution has overtaken. In the time of these persons, in succession to Domnus, Timaeus was in charge of the episcopate at Antioch, whom our contemporary Cyril succeeded. During Cyril's episcopate, we came to know Dorotheus, a learned man who had been deemed worthy of the presbyterate at Antioch. In his zeal for all that is beautiful in divine things, he made so careful a study of the Hebrew tongue that he read with understanding the original Hebrew scriptures. And he was by no means unacquainted with the most liberal studies and Greek primary education. But withal, he was by nature a eunuch, having been so from his very birth, so that even the emperor, accounting this as a sort of miracle, took him into his friendship and honored him with the charge of the purple dye works at Tyre. We heard him giving a measured exposition of the scriptures in the church. After Cyril, Tyrannus succeeded to the episcopate of the community of the Antiochenes, in whose day the attack upon the churches was at its height. After Socrates, as head of the community at Laodicea, came Eusebius, being a native of the city of Alexandria. The reason of his migration was the affair of Paul. For when he had come to Syria on business connected with Paul, he was prevented from returning home by those who had divine things at heart. He was a godly example of piety among our contemporaries, as it will be easy to discover from the expressions of Dionysius quoted above. Anatolius was appointed his successor, one good man, as they say, following another. He also was by race an Alexandrian, who for his learning, secular education, and philosophy had attained the first place among our most illustrious contemporaries. Inasmuch as in arithmetic and geometry, in astronomy and other sciences, whether of logic or of physics, and in the arts of rhetoric as well, he had reached the pinnacle, it is recorded that because of these attainments, the citizens there deemed him worthy to establish the school of the Aristotelian tradition at Alexandria. Now countless other of his deeds of prowess are related during the siege of Perugium at Alexandria, seeing that he was deemed worthy by all of an extraordinary privilege among the officials. But as an example, I shall make mention of the following one only. It is said that when the wheat failed the besieged, so that hunger was now a more intolerable thing than their enemies without, the person of whom we are speaking, being present, adopted the following device. The other part of the city was fighting in alliance with the Roman army, and thus was not besieged. Among these latter was Eusebius, for it is said that he was still there at that time before his migration to Syria, who had won so great fame and so widespread a reputation that it reached the ears even of the Roman general. To him Anatolius sent and informed him as to those that were perishing of hunger in the siege. When he learnt it, he asked the Roman commander as a very great favor to grant safety to deserters from the enemy, and, having obtained his request, acquainted Anatolius of the fact. The moment Anatolius received the promise, he assembled a council of the Alexandrians, and at first requested all to extend the right hand of fellowship to the Romans. But when he perceived that they were getting angry at the proposal, "At any rate," said he, "I do not think you would contradict me if I were to counsel that those who were extraneous and in no wise useful to us ourselves, old women and young children and old men, should be permitted to go outside the gates, whithersoever they wish. Why keep we these persons with us to no purpose, seeing they are all but on the point of death? Why destroy we with hunger the maimed and crippled in body, when we should support only men and youths, the husband, the necessary wheat for such as are required to guard the city. With some such arguments, he persuaded the assembly, and was the first to rise and give his vote that the whole body of those who were not required for the army, whether men or women, should depart from the city. Because, were they to remain and uselessly stay therein, there would be no hope of safety for them, since they would perish with hunger. And when all the rest of those in the assembly assented to this proposal, he went within a little of saving the whole of them that were besieged. He took care that first of all those belonging to the church, and then the rest remaining in the city of all ages, should escape, not only those who came under the terms of the vote, but also great numbers of others, passing themselves off as such, who secretly donned women's attire, and by his arrangement left the gates by night, and hastened to the Roman army. Eusebius was there to receive them all, and, like a father and physician, restore them, in evil plight after their long siege, with every kind of forethought and attention. Such were the two pastors that the church of Laodicea was deemed worthy to have successively, who, by divine providence, after the above-mentioned war, had left the city of the Alexandrians to come there. Not a very great many works, indeed, were composed by Anatolius, but enough have reached us to enable us to perceive both his eloquence and his great erudition. In these works, he especially presents his opinions with reference to the Pascha, from which it may be necessary on the present occasion to give the following passage. From the Canons of Anatolius on the Pascha. It is therefore in the first year, the new moon of the first month, which is the beginning of the whole 19-year cycle, on the 26th of Phamenote, according to the Egyptians, but according to the months of the Macedonians, the 22nd of Distrus, or, as the Romans would say, the 11th before the calends of April. The sun is found on the aforesaid 26th of Phamenote, not only to have arrived at the first sign of the zodiac, but already to be passing through the fourth day within it. This sign is commonly called the first of the 12 divisions, and the equinoctial sign, and the beginning of months, and head of the cycle, and the starting point of the planetary course. But the preceding sign is the last of the months, and the 12th sign, and the last of the 12 divisions, and end of the planetary circuit. Therefore, we say that they who place the first month in it, and determine the 14th day of the Pascha accordingly, are guilty of no small or ordinary mistake. And this is not our own statement, but the fact was known to the Jews, those of old time, even before Christ, and was carefully observed by them. One may learn it from what is said by Philo, Josephus, and Musaeus, and not only by them, but also by those still more ancient date, the two Agathobuli, surnamed the Masters of Aristobulus the Great. He was reckoned among the 70 who translated the sacred and divine Hebrew scriptures for Ptolemy Philadelphus and his father, and he dedicated books exegetical of the law of Moses to the same kings. These writers, when they resolve the questions relative to the Exodus, say that all equally ought to sacrifice the Passover after the vernal equinox, at the middle of the first month, and that this is found to occur when the sun is passing through the first sign of the solar, or, as some have named it, the zodiacal cycle. And Aristobulus adds that at the feast of the Passover, it is necessary that not only the sun should be passing through an equinoctial sign, but the moon also. For, as the equinoctial signs are two, the one vernal, the other autumnal, diametrically opposite each to the other, and as the 14th of the month at evening is assigned as the day of the Passover, the moon will have its place in the station that is diametrically opposed to the sun, as may be seen in full moons. And the one, the sun, will be the sign of the vernal equinox, while the other, the moon, will of necessity be in that of the autumnal. I know many other statements of theirs, some of them probable, others advanced as absolute proofs, by which they attempt to establish that the feast of the Passover and of the unleavened bread ought, without exception, to be held after the equinox. But I refrain from demanding proofs thus composed from those of whom the veil upon the law of Moses have been taken away, and for whom it now remains with unveiled face ever to behold as in a mirror Christ and the things of Christ, both what he learned and what he suffered. But that the first month with the Hebrews lies around the equinox is shown also by the teaching in the book of Enoch. And the same person has left behind an introduction to arithmetic, also in 10 complete treatises, and, as well, evidences of his study and deep knowledge of divine things. Theotechnus, bishop of Caesarea in Palestine, first had ordained him to the episcopate, seeking to procure him as his successor in his own community after his death, and indeed for some short time both presided over the same church. But the synod, with reference to Paul summoning him to Antioch, as he was passing by the city of the Laodiceans, he was retained there by the brethren, Eusebius having fallen asleep. And when Anatolius also departed this life, Stephen was appointed over the community there, the last bishop before the persecution. He won widespread admiration for his knowledge of philosophy and other secular learning, but he was not similarly disposed toward the divine faith, as the progress of the persecution clearly proved, demonstrating that the man was more of a dissembler, more of a craven and coward than a true philosopher. But indeed, the church and her affairs were not destined to perish because of him. They were set to rights by one who was immediately proclaimed bishop of that community by God himself, the Savior of all, even Theodotus, a man whose deeds themselves proved true his title to his own name and that of a bishop. He had reached indeed the first rank in the science of healing bodies, but in that of curing souls he was second to none among men, because of his benevolence, sincerity, fellow feeling, and zeal towards those that sought his aid, and he was also devoted to the study of divinity. Such a one was he. But at Caesarea in Palestine, Theotechnus, after exercising his episcopal office, in the most zealous fashion, was succeeded by Agapius, whom also we know to have labored much, displaying a most genuine regard for the government of his people, and with a liberal hand, caring especially for all the poor. In his day we came to know Pamphilius, a most eloquent man and a true philosopher in his mode of life, who had been deemed worthy of the presbyterate of that community. It would be of no small undertaking to show the kind of man he was and whence he came. But of each particular of his life and of the school that he established, as well as his contest in various confessions during the persecution, and the crown of martyrdom with which he was wreathed at the end of it all, we have treated separately in a special work concerning him. Truly, he was a most admirable man of those of that city. But as men possessed of especially rare qualities in our day, we know Pierius, one of the presbyters at Alexandria, and Meletius, bishop of the churches in Pontus. The former of these has been noted for his life of extreme poverty and for his learning in philosophy. He was exceedingly well practiced in the deeper study of divine things and in expositions thereof, as well as in his public discourses in church. Meletius, educated persons used to call him the honey of Attica, was such as one would describe as a most accomplished scholar in all respects. It is impossible to admire sufficiently his skill in oratory, yet this might be said to be his by a natural gift. But who could surpass the excellence of his great experience and erudition as well? Because, you would say, even on a single trial, that he was the most skillful and learned man in all branches of literature. Equally, too, was his life distinguished for its virtues. We took note of him during the period of the persecution, as for 7 whole years he was fleeing in the region of Palestine. In the church at Jerusalem, after the bishop Hymenaeus mentioned shortly before, Zabdus received the ministry. After no great time he fell asleep, and Hermo, the last of the bishops up to the persecution in our day, succeeded to the apostolic throne that has still been preserved there to the present day. And at Alexandria, too, Maximus, who had held the episcopate for 18 years after the death of Dionysius, was succeeded by Theonas. In his day at Alexandria, Achillas, deemed worthy of the presbyterate, along with Pierius, was well known. He had been entrusted with a school of the sacred faith, having displayed a wealth of philosophy most rare and inferior to none, and a manner of life that was truly in accordance with the gospel. After Theonas had given his utmost service for 19 years, Peter succeeded to the episcopate of the Alexandrians, and he too was especially prominent for 12 entire years. He ruled the church for less than 3 entire years before the persecution, and for the remainder of his days practiced a life of severer discipline, and cared in no hidden manner for the general good of the churches. For this reason, therefore, in the ninth year of the persecution, he was beheaded, and so adorned with the crown of martyrdom. In these books, having concluded the subject of the destruction of the places of prayer, a subject that extends over 305 years, come, let us next leave in writing, for the information of those that come after us, what the extent and nature have been of the conflicts in our own day of those who manfully contended for piety. Here ends Book 7 and Chapter 32, and this is the final chapter in Book 7, and so with this we end Book 7. Let's move on to some notes and commentary. This final chapter in Book 7 begins with a summary of the succession of bishops in various cities. In Rome, Felix was followed by the short-lived rule of Eutychianus, next came Gaius, and then Marcellinus. In Antioch, Domnus was followed by Timaeus and then Cyril. It is noted that during Cyril's time, the eunuch Dorotheus came to prominence, who was skilled in reading the Old Testament in the original Hebrew. After Cyril came Tyrannus, who was bishop when the attack upon the churches was at its height. Next, Eusebius turns to the community at Laodicea. Here he notes that Socrates was followed by Eusebius of Alexandria as bishop. He was apparently drafted for this office when he came from Alexandria for the synod regarding Paul of Samosata. After him came another bishop from Alexandria named Anatolius, a learned man who, Eusebius says, had been deemed worthy by those of Alexandria to establish a philosophic school there in the tradition of Aristotle. Eusebius then relays a rather lengthy anecdote to illustrate the worthiness of both Eusebius and Anatolius from a time when they were both in Alexandria and the city came under siege, and they were able to arrange for the protection of and provision for innocent civilians who were suffering under the siege. To illustrate Anatolius's gifts, Eusebius offers an extended citation from a work called The Canons of Anatolius on the Pascha. This work was dedicated to determining the proper calendar for the celebration of the Pascha. The translator and editor of this volume from which we're reading, J.E.L. Olton, offers an extended note on this work at the end of this chapter, which begins, "The Paschal Table of Anatolius is based on the supposition that after the lapse of every cycle of 19 years, the full moons recur on the same days of the month and at the same hours." Though noting that this method of calculation was, according to Olton, not strictly accurate, he adds that Anatolius rightly insisted that, quote, "the paschal full moon must fall after the equinox, as opposed to those who regarded the full moon, the 14th day, if it fell on the day before the equinox as the paschal moon," end quote. Eusebius further notes that Anatolius had written an introduction to arithmetic in 10 treatises. He had originally been sought out by Theotechnus of Caesarea in Palestine to succeed him as bishop there, but he was pressed into service at Laodicea after the death of Eusebius while traveling to Antioch for deliberations on Paul of Samosata. After Anatolius, Stephen was made bishop in Laodicea. He was the last bishop before the persecution. Though much admired before the persecution, Eusebius relays that Stephen did not prove to be a true philosopher, but a dissembler and a coward. Things were, however, in the providence of God, set right when the worthy Theodotus became bishop after Stephen. Theodotus, it seems, had been a prominent physician who had reached the first rank in the science of healing bodies, but as a pastor was second to none in the curing of souls. In Caesarea of Palestine, Theotechnus was succeeded by the worthy Agapius, distinguished in his care for the poor. Eusebius notes that in Agapius's day, he had come to know the presbyter Pamphilius, who had become Eusebius's mentor, whom he describes as the most eloquent man and a true philosopher in his mode of life. For more on Pamphilius, Eusebius refers readers to his work on the life of Pamphilius. Eusebius adds another note regarding godly men, including the presbyter Pierius of Alexandria and Meletius, who had been bishop of Pontus. Pierius, he says, was of note for his life of extreme poverty and for his learning in philosophy. Meletius was an accomplished scholar called the Honey of Attica, and the Greek word for honey is melu, and so it's a play on words. Meletius was the melu, or the Greek word, the honey of Attica. Meletius is described as having been a gifted orator who spent 7 years fleeing from the persecutions that would come in Palestine. In Jerusalem, Hymenaeus was followed by Zabdus and then Hermo, the last bishop before the persecution. It is noted that the throne of the bishops of Jerusalem was preserved up to that day, and that was mentioned earlier in Book 7 and Chapter 19. In Alexandria, Maximus was followed by Theonas. At this time, the presbyter Achillas was entrusted with the school of sacred faith in Alexandria. And after Theonas came Peter, who ruled 3 years before the persecution and 9 years afterwards, and was eventually crowned with martyrdom by beheading after 12 years of service as bishop. At the close of this book, Eusebius notes a transition in the narrative. Heretofore, the narrative has covered roughly the first 305 years of Christianity, from the birth of Christ right up to the threshold of the time of the Diocletian persecution, which would see the destruction of the places of prayer. In conclusion, this chapter continues Eusebius' pattern of tracing the succession of bishops in the key city centers of early Christianity and describing the prominent bishops, writers, and theologians of the era. With the end of Book 7, Eusebius sees this as a turning point as the Christian movement is on the verge of experiencing its greatest period of persecution. There is a sense, however, that it will be the church will be able to endure due to the stability, giftedness, and faithfulness of its leaders. For now, there is something of a calm before the coming storm of persecution. Here ends now this episode on Book 7 and Chapter 32. Hope this has been helpful and encouraging for those who are listening, and I will look forward to speaking to you in the next episode. Until then, take care and God bless.